When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Nomads Past and Present, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie Friedman, and my guest today is Selcan Küçüköksal. Selcan is a social anthropologist specializing in ecological anthropology. She completed her PhD at Humboldt University in Berlin and currently is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Barcelona, studying the effects of climate change on indigenous ecological knowledge in Siberia and the Amazon. Her first book, Embracing Landscape, Living with Reindeer and Hunting Among Spirits in South Siberia, published in 2021 by Barragán Books, examines human-animal relations and indigenous concepts of domestication and wilderness among the nomadic reindeer herder Duja of northern Mongolia. And that's what we'll be talking about today. So thank you so much, Selcan, for joining me.
Hey, thank you for inviting me, Maggie. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So first, could you explain a little bit for listeners who the Duja are? I think this is a very small community. I think in your book you said today the population is around 500 people or maybe even less, and probably entirely unfamiliar to listeners, I would imagine. So if you could just say a little bit, just the basic background info about where the Duja live and sort of what listeners need to know to understand kind of the history and culture of the Duja. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the Duja are like the smallest ethnic minority in Mongolia. They live in the northern Mongolia in the taiga forests. Like you said, they are more or less around 500 people at the moment, but not all of them are nomadic, but we're going to discuss that. So I think the last time I visited, which actually has been some time, there were around 150 or maximum 200 people who still live in the taiga, you know, with their reindeers and continue maintaining a nomadic lifestyle. And the interesting thing about Duja is that they have reindeers. So they are the only reindeer herders in Mongolia. And you know, they are actually originally from Tuvan Republic in Russia. So their native language is actually Duhan, which is a branch of Tuvan language. But of course, today they all speak Mongolian as well, but they are kind of, you know, their native language is different than Mongolian. And their history is also a little bit of interesting because, you know, they were in this border area on the taiga forest between Mongolia and Russia, you know, sort of going in between borders. But then more or less in 1940s, you know, the border was closed and they had to choose a site. So some of them stayed on the Mongolian side while there is still another community on the Russian side as well. So you know, since 1940s, you know, the Duja are more on the Mongolian side, let's say.
Mm. And in terms of subsistence methods, you define the Duja as both reindeer herders and hunter-gatherers. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like, how both sort of livestock pastoralism and hunting and gathering are practiced among the Duja?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things about the Duja community as well, which was also kind of the topic of my thesis dissertation. So, you know, they have reindeers. So in the first glance, they look like pastorals that just, you know, have reindeers, which is, of course, true in a way. But the thing is that they practice small-scale reindeer pastoralism, which means that the main function of the reindeer is more for riding and pecking, and for their milk, but not really for their meat. And also the reindeer don't have like economic value in terms of market economy. They do not sell the reindeer. They don't, you know, like really slaughter the reindeer unless they really need it. So the reindeers are more like the horse of the taiga, let's say, for the Dzukha. And their main subsistence is based on hunting and gathering. But of course, in this geography, which is really cold most of the time, it's more hunting. So that's why I say they are hunter-gatherers with reindeer. Because normally they hunt animals like, you know, deer, bears, elk, moose, or wild reindeer, while they keep the reindeer for riding, packing, and for the milk. Yeah, and that really is very interesting because, you know, in my dissertation, I was looking into human-animal relations and, you know, all these big theories about hunter-gatherers' relations with animals and then pastoralists, you know, this changing relations. And my question was, well, yeah, Dzukha are one of the rare communities that have both domesticated animals, but while they are mainly hunters. So that kind of brings, you know, different interesting things about human-animal relations, let's say.
Right. And so the last section of your book, you discuss the hunting ban that's been implemented in this region by the Mongolian government in this kind of national park area where the Dzukha live, which is a phenomenon that's not isolated to this context, this kind of conservation-oriented ban on hunting in territories occupied by indigenous peoples, which have these really profound repercussions. So during your research, you were there, I believe, when this hunting ban was first implemented, and then were able to observe the changes that it affected among the Dzukha. Can you talk about that, about what some of those changes were in this relatively short period of time of less than 10 years, right, since this hunting ban? What are some of those changes that have occurred among the Dzukha?
Yeah, that's very important because it kind of affects their subsistence styles recently because, I was just saying that they are hunter-gatherers, but it's true that with this recent ban, it is kind of changing. So what happened is in 2011, the area that they live was declared a national park. And then I was there in 2013, and because the rules kind of started to be implemented more in a few years, I guess. So, suddenly, you know, let's say in one day for the Dzukha, because I was there at that day that the authorities came with some papers in their hands saying that, okay, now this is a national park and you cannot hunt here anymore. And here is a list of how much fine you are supposed to pay if you hunt, you know, certain animals. Of course, it was completely shocking because, again, like I said, because of their reindeer, I think people see them more like pastoralists, while the reindeers do not really have that kind of economic value for the society. So if they cannot hunt, what are they gonna do? It's like really impossible to survive. So what happened is, of course, they didn't stop hunting in one day. They kept hunting at least for the next 4 or 5 years that I was there. But it was illegal and it started to change a lot of things. First of all, of course, they could hunt much less. They were extremely nervous because there were some serious controls at some time as well. Because even actually there was an incident that some group of young men were almost arrested in 2015, I think it was. So it's not like they put these rules and they forgot about them, but like they were really checking on them, you know. And I think an important change that happened is that after a couple of years after this ban, the government realized that, of course, that doesn't make sense because, you know, people cannot go to the supermarkets to buy meat, like they are hunters. And they started to kind of give some small salaries, like a stipend, to the people to compensate for this. But I think that has become a big change. Like, so people were, of course, happy about that because like many nomadic societies today, of course, they have a strong connection with the outside world. You know, the children go to school, some people work, you know, some young people live in the village, older people usually settle to the village. So of course, they need money, you know, to pay for all these expenses. it was good. They liked to have that, you know, so that they had kind of like a more stable income, let's say. But on the other hand, I saw that a lot of changes started to occur in the society because, for instance, alcoholism. Like, men could not really hunt like before. They were kind of left without anything to do in winters, and they had the money. So I saw that a lot of young men started to spend this money on alcohol, you know, not to buy meat. Or also something very interesting, that a lot of families started to build houses in the village with that money. They kind of used it. Well, as I said, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but they're, like, it kind of changed certain things in the society. And also, I think in terms of a more deeper feeling, you know, this idea that they are controlled in their own home, or they are criminalized in their own landscape, in their home, really, really created a big difference, because it felt very unfair to everybody, you know. They were even saying that, well, we see people hunting, like people from outside, from the steppe, from the village, or even foreigners sometimes, that they hunt here illegally, and nobody's controlling them, but they control us because they know that we live here, you know. So that kind of created this feeling of unfairness, let's say, and also this feeling of weakness. You know, I could see that people were feeling that they are not in control in their own home, which must be like a really terrible feeling. And the last thing is that I think, I didn't witness that, but my theory is that that may also be something that affects human-animal relations in long term, for sure. Because maybe we can discuss this, of course, later. But, you know, hunting is not just a means to get meat, but it's a way of connecting to the landscape, to the land spirits. Because there are like really, really a lot of detailed rules about how to hunt, where to hunt. It's very much related with land spirits, land owners. You know, there are certain areas that you can hunt, other areas that are filled with ancestral spirits, so you cannot hunt there. And there are certain local spirits that control hunting. So it's a way of interacting with the geography. And I think when hunting is gone, that's all gonna lose its meaning slowly, you know. So because this exchange between the landscape and people through hunting is, I think, one of the main concepts of animism in the taiga. So what I mean by that is that for the Zuha, hunting is considered like a gift from the land spirits. So like, to have success in hunting, it's not about technical hunting skills, but it's about what kind of relations you have with the land spirits, and if you deserve a hunt or not. It's a gift. It's basically a gift, you know. So now that this is not there anymore, you know, this exchange, let's say, this mutual exchange with the spirits and landscape is going to decrease, and I believe that may affect things in long term. And lastly, sorry, I talked too much, but lastly, I think that may also change the relations with the reindeer, because what happens is, because of this hunting ban, now I think the Duha kind of give more focus on reindeer herding, because that's the only thing that is left for them. That's the only reason that makes sense to stay in the taiga. So right now they have small-scale reindeer pastoralism, like I said at the beginning. And from what I read and from what I know is that actually most other reindeer herders in the north also were practicing small-scale reindeer herding, but then through time they became more like, you know, big scale market economy based herding. And of course the relations between reindeer and human are not the same, you know, because right now there are only few reindeers, and as I said, they are not involved in the market economy. They don't slaughter them, they don't sell them. But once the herders started to sell their animals, I'm not saying it changes completely, but it kind of affects some dynamics. So that may be something that can happen to the Duha as well.
Yeah. And so can you talk about sort of how you would define or understand the nature of the value of the reindeer to the Dukha, or sort of what the Dukha reindeer relations are? Because you said they don't have sort of an economic value, right? It's not a kind of capitalistic value. Something just like one sentence in your book that stood out to me is the fact that you wrote that whenever you would ask people to quantify their reindeer herds, they sort of weren't able to, that they couldn't put an exact number of like, oh yeah, I have 15 reindeer. They could name their reindeer individually and they knew their kind of individual characteristics and sort of knew them as like individual, almost like persons or like as members of their family in a way, but that they couldn't see their herd as a kind of totality in a way. And I think that's a really interesting, I think that sheds some light on how these relations between the Dukha and their herds are conceived. So can you just talk a little bit about that, about what that kind of traditional nature of the relationship between the Dukha and their reindeer?
And that's something I also discussed in detail in my book, like you were saying, because, normally, of course, like human relations with domesticated animals can also really depend, like in their economical value, if they're going to sell it, if they spend a lot of time with the animal or not. And in the case of Dukha, because they do not slaughter the animals regularly, but as I said, it's not like a taboo. You know, if an animal is too old, is ill, or if there is like an emergency situation that they don't have food, they can slaughter the animals. But normally they prefer not to because they have just a few. And like 15, 20 is considered kind of like few because for the nomadism, actually, reindeers are very important because they have to pack. And I think an average family of four people would need at least 10 reindeers, or if not more, for migration, because then four people will ride for reindeers and then others to pack. The fact that they keep the reindeers all their lives means that one family will spend with an individual reindeer almost like 15 years. So it's kind of like the dogs, let's say, like pets, you know, they spend a long time together. And of course, that gives opportunities to get to know each other, let's say, to make it more simple, you know. They do name their reindeer one by one. They can recognize the reindeer, individual reindeers, even from their sound, you know, so because it's a long time spent together. So I would say that this is why the relations are intimate. But of course, it's not the relations of pet keeping that we know in the cities. It's another type of relation still. Do they own the reindeers or do they consider themselves as the owners of the reindeer? I mean, they do. In a way, they do. And of course, there is quite a lot of controls imposed on the reindeer because, they do take the reindeer to the pasture, then sometimes they tie it, they castrate the reindeer. So I wouldn't really say that, they do not have any kind of control on the reindeer. Of course, they do have a control, but what I claim in my book is I think this control is a bit similar to parental control. Like, because, of course, also parents do control their children. They have a lot of rules. They do things that children do not want to do. But in the end, it's a nurturing control that is not really based on domination, but it's based on care and nurturing, let's say. And I think there are really interesting things that shows us that reindeer are kind of like in the family kinship system of the Dukha, because, for instance, the Dukha believe that when a person breaks a taboo in hunting or in other domains of life, people are kind of responsible also from each other's deeds. Like if a hunter, let's say, hunts a pregnant animal, then his wife may also get sick, let's say. So community members kind of have, they have relations in that sense that people are responsible for other people's faults as well. And reindeer are also in that system, you know. They believe that, like, somebody does something wrong and their herd may be attacked by wolves, let's say. Or similarly, like they choose a sacred reindeer to protect the family. Actually, they have that also in Mongolian hearts in the steppes as well. And then this reindeer has also power to protect the family. So to cut it short, I think this is why it's different than large-scale reindeer herding, that there is an individual relationship between people and their reindeer. And this number issue, that they don't say the number, is, I think it's because for sure the number is not important in terms of how many reindeer do we have this year so that we can slaughter this much or we can sell this much. Like, maybe that's why they don't care so much about the number. And the second thing is, I think, and I heard this among other pastoralists as well, it's kind of not considered very good to tell a number, because then, you know, there is some kind of bad energy, let's say. Like, if you specify numbers of your herd, it's possible that somebody think it's too much. Maybe they're jealous, so you may lose the herd. So there is this kind of unspoken beliefs.
In the sense of, like, it would sort of induce personal envy, or in the sense of, like, this kind of larger kind of karmic, cosmic balance?
I think both. That's my feeling is, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think that starts to get a really interesting topic of the nature of control and control of the landscape among the Duha, and the extent to which that is perceived as possible and desirable. And something you write about in your book is this idea among anthropologists that pastoralism, and with pastoralism, or with, like, the domestication of animals, comes kind of greater control of the landscape and over one's natural environment. That if you're going to domesticate animals, that then by definition that requires you to exert some kind of control over your surroundings, and that changes kind of the mindset with which one approaches one's natural surroundings, where you start to see yourself as kind of the master of animals or of the landscape, as opposed to living in this more symbiotic or kind of mutually dependent relationship with animals or with the natural environment. And so it seemed really interesting to me from your findings among the Duha is that I think you're quite clear that this idea of control doesn't really exist, even though they are a pastoralist people as well as a hunting community, and that there is seemingly kind of no sense of the environment as something that should be controlled or that can be controlled or that they want to control. And so all of these ideas that you bring up in your book of this kind of karmic balance that needs to be maintained in order for hunting to be successful, in order for migrations to be successful, or this idea that you shouldn't, or that you can't or won't assign value to your herds, or even quantify your herds, and that can carry sort of retributions with it. I think these are really interesting examples of how the Duha experience their landscape through this sort of shared, through the combination of pastoralism and hunting, and how the dual practice of those two subsistence methods in turn inform experiences of the landscape and interactions with the landscape.
So what I realized, and I would actually like to discuss your experience with that briefly after I say this, is landscape, the geography, to me at the end of my research, seemed like the core of everything. Because, and I think the general approach, just to keep it very simple, is we can say that it's home. It's home for people, it's not a foreign geography, it's home for people, but it's also home for the reindeer And it's also home for the animals that they hunt. So I think the basic concept, that's why I call my book Embracing Landscape, is that all these three parties, they perceive, let's say, the tiger forest in that case, as their home. And what I realized is that people really, really keep talking about the tiger. Like, we discuss the hunting, we discuss reindeers, you know, we discuss different aspects of life. But then one thing that always comes back is people are talking about their lovely tiger and how they want to go there. And if they're in the village for 5 days, they're already bored and they miss the tiger. Old people are always complaining like, oh, I want to go back to the tiger, you know. So it is their home. And to me at the beginning, or let's say to maybe to anyone who lives in a city, it's kind of hard to understand, because it's like when you look from an outsider's perspective, we are in the middle of nothing, you know. Okay, we see forests, we see mountains, valleys, but it's like a really harsh, you know, like, let's say, wild geography that is very difficult to have any reference points for us, no? And then I realized that, of course, for them, this is really home. Like, I don't know, like the kind of similar feeling that maybe we would have in the city that we grow up, no? Or in a town that we grow up. Like, we turn a valley and then people have this, I call it like map of memories that, you know, because maybe they were there 2 years ago and they lost their reindeer. And we are in another area. Of course, this is also connected with the local spirits and the animistic worldview, let's say. But then it's mixed. It's this, like memories with spirits, but also memories with animals or memories among people. But then, I don't know, we are in another autumn camp, let's say, and somebody will say, oh, you know, I was here and maybe the first time that she fell in love with someone, you know, like we are in another faraway mountain and somebody said, oh, like my first trip with my father that passed away after a couple of years was here. We were here making a fire. So of course it's everything is so familiar and people really, really miss it when they are away from the taiga. And it is true, like you said, in the case of Tuha, because they are more like they have more animistic worldview. Of course, this is connected with a lot of spirits and ancestors as well. But what is interesting to me, and that's what I wanted to ask you, is I think this is also kind of connected with the nomadic pastoralism or nomadic lifestyle. Because one thing that I never forget, I don't know if you had similar experiences, it's you know, there is this one of the last nomadic pastoral societies in Turkey, and I didn't work with them as a researcher, but I was visiting them, let's say, out of personal curiosity. And then there was this old man in the village that heard that I was going to live with a family, like who is in the pastoral move. And he said to me, oh, in this area right now that you are going, because it's spring, in that particular area, there is this tree. Please send my greetings to the tree. Oh, you know, we're talking about Turkey. It's not like when you look from outside, it's not like an animistic society in terms of shamanism and all these things. But no. And I remember exactly the same thing. Old people were really missing being out there in the pasture, in the valleys, in the mountains, wherever they are, you know. So I thought, wow, this connection with landscape for nomadic people is really strong, you know. It's something, of course, related with animals, but I feel like it's even beyond that. I don't know if you had this kind of experiences, but...
Certainly, yeah. I mean, yeah, so in my research on the Bedouin in the Middle East, I think you get the same phenomenon of kind of sacred importance, even in the modern day, you know, even under kind of formal Islam, you know, you still get these really strong sentiments and familial ties and senses of heritage attached to natural features in the landscape, attached to trees, attached to mountain, like specific like mountain peaks or like high places in the landscape, attached to water. Of course, that's of course really important in arid climates, attached to certain springs or wells or reservoirs or things like that. I don't know if I would say that it's like a sense of spirits so much anymore, especially in the modern context, but certainly this idea of ancestral connections to certain natural features. And I think that does come from the fact of, from where Bedouin burials are practiced, that you bury, you tend to bury, especially like important people in your family, especially the sheikh or the tribal leader or whoever, will be buried near a kind of important place in the landscape. And then you sort of visit that place. It's important because of its natural features. So you visit it continuously year after year in your migrations. But then because there's an important person buried there, those two things kind of mutually reinforce each other. And that place becomes important for both of those reasons, both for the, like, whatever important natural feature is there and for the grave of whatever important person is buried there. And those two things and the significance of those can't be kind of unentangled from each other. It seemed to me that there's a similar thing among the Dukha as well, although you wrote that in terms of burial practices, like the whole taiga is a cemetery, basically. So I was actually wondering what that looks like among the Dukha in terms of burial practices, and then in terms of how sort of memory and this sort of ancestral memory is preserved and maintained in relation to the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Dukha still practice sky burial, let's say, you know, especially if they're in the taiga. And I think people who live in the villages are buried, but if somebody dies in the taiga, they do leave the body outside for the animals to consume. I've never actually witnessed that. Like, it's never happened when I was there, but I was just, you know, asking people and listening to stories about it. So that is, of course, I think one of the other reasons that kind of makes this geography more sacred. I don't know if sacred is the right word here, but because the dead are also part of the memories, you know, like in every camp, let's say, because basically, sorry, I never mentioned that basic information, but basically the Dukha move more or less maybe 5-6 times a year. And they are a bit more stable in winters, actually, especially recently. They mostly go to the same winter camp. Even two families, they have wooden houses in this winter camp, while others are still staying in the tent. But because they chose this winter camp because it's really close to the village, because, you know, children go to school. So it's like, in terms of more practical reasons, let's say, they choose that winter camp. While before, they were obviously taking the reindeer to much further valleys. But now what they do is they still take the reindeer to faraway valleys, but they leave the reindeer there. And then families take turns to control the reindeers. But apart from winter, I think their summer camp is also more or less maybe the same camp. And in autumn and spring, they move more. But more or less maybe 6 times a year they move, I would say, these days. And of course, around all these places, as much as memories of people or animals or spirits, also there is people had to leave their loved ones after they died, you know. So that's another factor that kind of adds more emotions, let's say, to the landscape. But also, apart from that, there is also certain ancestral places that each family have kind of specific areas where the shaman of their family, but in the old times, were buried. Buried now, you know, buried, sky buried. Well, it's difficult to find the vocabulary. So families are supposed to go visit these ancestral places that are called the Hilga every year to give their offerings. Of course, nowadays they are not able to do it every year, and also some of them are on the other side of the border. So there is also official reasons that some families cannot visit their Dahilga. But still, you know, apart from like this, you know, personal memories, there is also more ancestral ties that each family has. And apart from that, also there is other spiritual ties that applies to everybody. like a certain local spirit that resides on a mountain, or like a certain lake that is important, and people have to give offerings to that lake as well. You know, so there is, it's very complicated. You know, like at the beginning you think like, okay, the landscape is spirited, so they have, they believe that they have spirits, but of course, no, it's very, very complex beliefs and information about that. But yes, the deaths are, of course, I think, like one of the big factors that people are so deeply attached to the landscape. And I think even the relations with the land, the reindeer, is kind of connected to the, to this attachment to the landscape. Because look, when we look more simply, I think that's something that you also discuss in one of your podcasts, like why do these people live in such hard conditions, you know? So in terms of Duha, like they were hunters, and okay, hunting is really like a very direct relation with the landscape, with the geography. But now that they cannot even hunt, they don't have an economic benefit from the reindeers. Really, it would be so easy for them just to settle to the village and maybe have sheep, other types of animals that they can still herd in the village, let's say. But no, they want to stay in the taiga, and reindeer are kind of the only means to stay in the taiga, because what happens is reindeer is the only domesticated animal that can survive in the taiga. And right now, the Duha do not have mobile snowmobiles like the Sami or like some other communities in Siberia. So there is no other way of staying in the taiga if you don't have reindeer. So they kind of need the reindeer. Actually, more than the reindeer need people, this is for sure. Because another interesting thing about reindeer is that it's an animal that they, that doesn't need to be fed artificially, but they just they find their own food. Reindeer, people don't feed the reindeer by collecting food. So yeah, people need the reindeer if they want to be in the taiga. That's basically very much related with the landscape as well.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking about as well in my question earlier, this sense that it, that the taiga is sort of, is first and foremost kind of the reindeer's home, and the Duha are almost like visitors in a way. Not quite, that's not like, that's not quite the right way of putting it, but there, but the, I think it seemed to me like there is this sense of that the reindeer are the one who are sort of the ones who belong there. This is the reindeer's home, and the Duha kind of experience the taiga in many ways through the reindeer, or because of the reindeer in a lot of ways. So that and just the way that sort of the Duha perception of the landscape and attachment to the landscape is led by the reindeer first, in a way, is really interesting. And so I wanted to ask, on that note, so much of your book and your research is about domestication versus wilderness or wildernization. And so I wanted to ask how you kind of define those concepts and those terms in this context, because I think it's quite a tricky and nuanced context to approach those categories of animal domestication, like you sort of just brought up, versus wild animals. And I think this is a really interesting case study into what those categories can mean. And you seem, I think throughout your book, you're quite hesitant to use either of those terms, or at least you use them with a lot of kind of nuance and qualifications. So even though it is an extremely, I know it's like a very large and complicated topic, I was hoping you could start to just spell out some of those nuances of some of the of those categories of domesticated versus wild animals and domesticated versus wild landscapes as well.
No, like you say, it's quite a technical and complicated issue. And even while I'm talking, every time I'm like, oh, I shouldn't use that vocabulary, I shouldn't say that. But let me see if I can manage to like really, really make it simple and summarize. But I mean, maybe like that way I can make it more simple. So of course, if you want to understand what is domesticated or what is domestication, what is wild, I started very simply. Like let's ask in their native language, if people have these categories, no? It's like a very simple start, but I think it can give us a lot of clues. So, for instance, for reindeer, no? They have their domesticated reindeer, but they also have wild reindeer, the same species that live in the wilds that do not live together with people. So I was wondering if they call it also domesticated reindeer and wild reindeer, or for the animals. And for reindeers, I realized that the categories were quite different than that. So what happened is they have two completely different words for domesticated reindeer and wild reindeer. What we say domesticated reindeer and wild reindeer. And for their domesticated reindeer, they say ibi. And ibi is, I couldn't really find the etymology of the word very clearly, but it could be related with the word deer, let's say. Ibi, they call it. But the wild reindeer, they call it completely different in a new vocabulary, which is jailikan. And that literally means the game that belongs to the land. So here it's not so much like wilderness or domestication of the animal, but it's more like the affiliation of the animal, no? Like the animal that belongs to the land and the animal, ibi, that belongs to the household, let's say, because also the word ibi can be related with the word home in Turkic languages, not exactly in Duha, ög, ibi, but you know, I have read a couple of linguists that makes this connection, but that's not completely certain. But two different categories that has nothing to do with the wildernization or domestication of the animals. But on the other hand, for the ibi, for their domesticated reindeer, they have two other words that they use. One is omak, which means animal that is, let's say, wild in the terms that is difficult to control. And Josh, an animal that is calm. So I don't want to make it very complicated, but you see these categories are just not exactly like the categories that we have in the academic categories, let's say, no? So then it means that if you want to understand these concepts, in a way we should forget about all these categories and then start from the beginning, you know, like trying to look at from people's perspective, which was, of course, very complicated, but... Like, just as a summary, I realized that these categories, of course, they differentiate these two categories, but just the meaning attributed to them is not exactly the same. And I think I can just maybe conclude that wild is not wild in terms of wild's character, but it's more like animals that belong to the land and that belong to the spirits and that are outside of the household. And the domesticated animals, I think, are a bit more like family members, and also because of some cosmological rules that they have that I mentioned before. And I think this is kind of the main difference, you know. So this is why they behave like the way they behave is also kind of like this. Like, we do not behave exactly the same to strangers that are on the street, let's say. And also the people from the family or from the larger family. But that doesn't mean that we behave our family members better necessarily and the others. No, sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes we behave strangers even more politely because the relations are a bit more delicate, you know, which is really happening sometimes with wild animals while hunting. Like, the respect is maybe more at the core of the relations because, as I said, for hunting, you know, respecting the animals is really important to deserve this hunt, etc. So it's another subject, but this is a way of treating animals, let's say. While reindeers, let's say domesticated reindeers in our own academic term, it's another kind of relations that are a bit more intimate, a bit more close, more like family relations that are certainly more intimate, but sometimes that can also be a bit more problematic in terms of having that you think that you have more rights on these people, you know? So yeah, let's summarize like this to make it simple.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. And I think I like the way both just now when you're speaking and in your book, you draw these analogies to kind of personal relationships, which I think makes the nature of these relationships more comprehensible to those of us who, you know, who are from other contexts, other countries, who grew up in cities. And yeah, creating a sense of animals as having a kind of personhood, and that human animal relations, that even that phrase isn't sort of the most accurate, and that if we want to understand those relations, we should envision them as being more like human to human relationships as well, rather than casting them in the mold of a kind of completely different category of relations. I'll stop with the difficult questions for now.
Thank you.
I'm just curious about how you got into this research, how you sort of made your way to the Dukha as a, you know, as we've said, a very small and somewhat remote community that isn't very well known. How did you sort of encounter this area of research?
Yeah, that was kind of also a bit by chance. So I was on a long trip in Asia, and the final destination of the trip was Mongolia. So I heard about the Dukha. You know, there's this community in the north that there are Noahs, they live with their reindeer. So I was already very interested, but I couldn't go at the time because it's really difficult to reach from the capital to where the Dukha live. But then I went back, and during my studies, actually I started in my master's, that I took a class called Shamanism and Central Asia. And then I was really interested in these topics of animism, and also we kind of studied a lot about nomadic societies in this class. So I kind of had a general interest, let's say, to societies that are nomadic or that practice shamanism, that have a bit of a more animistic worldview, and that have animals. And then I remembered the Dukha. Ah, there was this community in Mongolia that I heard about when I went there. And to me it was interesting because they do also practice shamanism. They are nomadic, they have reindeers. But what is personally interesting for me is that also their native language, Tuvan or Duhan, is from the same family with Turkish, which is my native language. So I thought, oh, wow, I could even learn their language kind of easily compared to another language to start from zero. So I kind of were really interested. I thought, okay, that has everything I am interested, so why not? And then I started researching. Of course, there are other researchers who work in the area, so I started contacting some of these researchers. Actually, one of them, a linguist, Elizabeth Regagning, was in Turkey. I met her in a conference. I asked her. So like this, slowly and slowly, I got the introduction and contacts. And then I kind of went there, out of the blue, let's say. But that's how it all started, yeah.
And so what about your methodology in general? Because you're not just an academic researcher, but you also work as a journalist, as a photojournalist, and your book is beautifully illustrated with some really evocative photographs of the people and of the landscape. So can you talk about that maybe approach to your studies, how you combine kind of academic research and methodologies with maybe a more journalist-driven or kind of public education-driven approach to this topic, if you do that at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, it's true that I have been working as a photojournalist for a magazine, let's say more than 10 years maybe, and also in recent years I'm working for documentaries, like sometimes as co-directing or sometimes, you know, as like consultant for other people's documentaries. So I think maybe even my anthropological interest comes from that, because I was actually working as a photojournalist, and then I started studying anthropology a bit later than that. And my feeling was that as a photojournalist that covers more cultural stories, because I was working for a magazine that is kind of like geography culture magazine, so we were covering anthropological stories, and I really enjoyed it a lot. I still enjoy it a lot, but I always felt like it's missing something. You know, I do visit communities, or I cover different stories, but I'm there just for a week or 2 weeks. So I just have the gist of it, but I want to go deeper. And it was at that moment that I decided to start studying anthropology. So my journalism background is even older than anthropology. And I think this is a great combination. I really love it. Because it is true that most of our anthropological research could be like a journalist story, let's say. And of course, it's always nice to share your work with the public. So that's why I really enjoy, of course, going deep into the subject, but I also love to take photographs or videos and to make it available for the public in a more understandable language, let's say. And I really enjoy creative writing. So, well, the problem is I'm used to it so much that to me it is more challenging to write academic articles because, you know, it's like, oh man, am I amongst people to understand it, you know? But anyway, you know, this discussions, it's another subject, like language of academia, of course, doesn't also have to be very complicated. I think it's nice that now a lot of anthropological work or in anthropology, we also use this kind of more creative language or writing style in recent years. So that's the reason why I really like anthropology too. But of course, having this both jobs is sometimes very complicated as well. Because it is true that as much as I enjoy it, it's sometimes also very challenging because what the media wants is, of course, quite different than our long, deep anthropological research. And I have this dilemma all the time, you know, all the time because, for instance, just I can give you an example, no? Like, to cut it short, like, even if you are working as a journalist for a newspaper, for a magazine, or if you are making a film for a TV channel, you are never in full control of what you are doing. So basically, you have the subject, you write things, but there are editors, no? There is production companies, there is, like, it goes through many people, and these people are, of course, not anthropologists, so their concerns are not so much ethical always, but it's more about to take attention, to take public attention, to make it look more interesting, you know. So this is why it is true that I had there has been incidents that I was also disappointed from the last version of my work because I was like, oh no, that's not, like for instance, the title. I don't know if it is the same, but most of the time as the author of an article, you are not the one who write the title, and it's the editors. And the same for documentary films. So, for instance, one incident, just to keep it very short, with my work in Doha, what happened is that I wrote an article and I had photographs, and the article, I saw the last version, and everything was fine. But then it came up with this title of something like The Lost Tribe. I'm like, oh no! But, like, you know, it's no! But you see what I mean, right? But it was already out there and I had no control on it. And then, well, yeah, you can imagine the rest. And the same thing happened with the film documentaries that I worked for. So it's complicated. It's I love it. I really feel privileged to be able to reach out my work to the public. But then there's all these complications that comes with it. And well, you should be ready and you should be aware that you will not always be in charge and you will criticize for that, blah, blah, blah. So, but in general, I strongly believe that more academic work should be available to public. And this is a risk that we should take as academicians because, well, yeah, it's important, I think, that people know about our work.
I completely agree. So how do you, when you were conducting research among the Doha, how did you frame your position, your intentions, and maybe the outcome of your research to them? You know, I'm sure people must have asked you, what are you doing here? Why are you interested in this? Like, what brought you here? I'm sure these are conversations you must have had over and over again. So how did you explain that to them? How did you, you know, I think what's maybe slightly unique about your research is that, you know, if you're doing both, producing both a dissertation, but also more public-oriented pieces, if you're producing photojournalism pieces, if you're producing documentaries, those are reach a wider audience. Whereas when you're only conducting kind of academic research, maybe nobody is going to read that except your dissertation committee and some random person like me, you know, the very small audience. So how did you kind of explain that or present that mm-hmm. to the people you are talking to? You know, what the kind of outcome or reception of your work was going to be? Who was the audience that you were going to kind of present the Duha and the people you were living among to?
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's, I think in that question also, photojournalism part was a bit more comprehensive for the Duha, I guess. So my methodology was like, it was a typical ethnography. You know, I lived with one family for like 11 months. I was Taiga a few times. And at the beginning, of course, it was like, I guess like always, it's a bit difficult to explain that to people, no? Like I am, well, like, writing a dissertation, and to make it more simple, I want to understand your culture, I want to write these things, I want to, you know, like, keep these things, but it's always, I mean, they were always very welcoming, I'm always very grateful to them for that, but of course it was a bit more, not so understandable as well, right, what exactly I'm doing, and like, because there is nothing concrete. But then also, the first time I went, it was the time that I covered a story about them in the magazine, and I was telling them about that, you know, and that they understood, of course, because for sure they have newspapers, they have magazines that they're aware. And the second time I went to the Taiga, first of all, I could take something concrete with me, like the magazine itself. And everybody was so happy to see themselves on the magazine and everything. But I think more importantly, the consequences of that helps people a lot, because what happened is, I think I was lucky, it doesn't happen every time we publish something in a magazine, but what happened is that that issue became quite popular in Turkey. It was for a Turkish magazine. And then let's say we have like a government agency in Mongolia that are working with communities, and they saw it, they contacted me, they asked me if there is anything they can do for the Duha. Then I took it to the people, I told them about it, and then there were some let's say social projects that this agency conducted with the Duha, like for instance well, they actually brought reindeers from Russia to them for to make the genetic pool a bit larger, because this is something that the Duha wanted. Well, it's a complicated subject, but that they wanted. Also, they kind of because the Mongolian government gave Duha solar panels and the material that to cover their tents. And but most of them were very old, so this agency also helped them buy things. But anyway, to cut it short, as I said, I was also lucky. It doesn't always happen like that. But the consequences of this article was something very concrete for the society. And of course, I was very happy that, you know, I was the mediator, let's say, between them and this what happened. And of course, also, you know, it's always very complicated, no? As an anthropologist, you are a burden on people for such a long time and you want to give something back. And, you know, it's not always so easy. Or, of course, we want to believe that our work will be the thing that we give back. And I still believe in that in the long term. But it was very nice and satisfying to see like a more short term, something to give back in the short term. And that happened, to be honest, thanks to the article than the dissertation.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, because I think so many times academic researchers, we want to think, you know, ideally that our research will have those outcomes. And I think often we, when we're doing field work, we present ourselves to the people we're working with as being able to create those kind of outcomes. But very often that just doesn't happen because of the kind of, you know, the very small audience for academic research and publications. It just doesn't reach the number of people or reach the right people to be able to actually create social or political change. So that's a really interesting example of other methodologies, or maybe a combination of methodological approaches with kind of academic and more kind of popular oriented writing and media that can create something tangible, that can have some output and change.
I mean, as I said, it has cons and pros, no? Because of this particular article, to make it more concrete, it was the article that they said, like, the lost tribe thing. that I felt terrible as an anthropologist. And it's true that I was faced with a lot of criticism from academicians. Of course, I understand completely their criticism. It was just like, I didn't do it. But anyway, you can't explain that to people. But on the other hand, the same article had this kind of consequences for the society. So I think it's, if you are going into the area of the media as a researcher, I think we should do our best, but then we should also accept that there will be compromises to be made at some point. So which one you choose or the balance is something that every case will be different, of course. But yeah, it's pros and cons like anything, I guess, in life.
Yeah, yeah, I think that balance of trying to be a good academic, but also a good journalist. If you're going to try to wear both hats, you want to do both things well, but sometimes those, the goals and what constitutes good scholarship or good journalism, those don't always align. So yeah, where you're going to make those compromises and in whose interest are large ethical questions that I think more people should think about more carefully, or that anthropologists and scholars in general should maybe receive better training on. I don't know.
No, that is true. I completely agree. We should definitely get training about that because it's really important. And
yeah. So we are out of time, unfortunately. I feel like there's so much more that we could talk about. But nevertheless, thank you so much for joining me and sharing your research, your insight into the Doha, your insight into your methodological approaches and approach to anthropological scholarship and fieldwork. I think there's a lot that other scholars could learn from your work.
So much. No, thank you so much, Maggie. Well, I do love your podcast, listening to other episodes, and these issues are, I love discussing them, you know, like we could, I feel that we could discuss and talk for hours and hours. So thank you so much. It's been like really fun for me to be here.